Yemeni parties welcome cabinet reshuffle. We're joined on the line by Hisham Umaisi, political information analyst live from Sana'a, Yemen. Hisham, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Jazakumullah khair for joining us. We appreciate your time on Radio Islam. Hisham, tell us, is the bombing continuing daily in Yemen?
It is, but it has winded down lately. There's been some sort of a de-escalation ahead of the ceasefire and a peace talks that are scheduled on April 18th. So it has slowed down significantly.
The success of the ceasefire set for 10th April, as you alluded to, is this an attempt at peace?
It is an attempt at peace, but the question is it achievable? You have multiple warring sides on the ground. We're not sure if all of them were invited to the peace talks table. So their buy-in, their commitment to ceasefire is not guaranteed. And to be honest with you, with the fighting basically happening within cities and the warring sides within almost 10 meters from each other, fighting from house to house, it is going to be very difficult to maintain a ceasefire. That's assuming it commenced, actually, that they committed to it.
Yes, so that is the commitment that is needed. Peace talks scheduled for 18 April. How are people on the ground feeling about it?
To be honest with you, they're very skeptical. The UN announced the peace talks almost a couple of weeks ago, but they did not announce who exactly was invited to the peace talks. Is it basically the usual suspects, or it's an all-inclusive peace talks? Now, since the start of the war, it's no longer just a couple or a handful of words. Those groups have been fragmented. There are multiple sides now. There are a lot of warlords, of course, and militia groups on the ground. And as long as all of them are not involved in the peace talks, whatever is the outcome of April 18th, it's not going to be binding to everybody on the ground, hence the fighting will continue, in addition to the fact that the UN set a very high bar expectations for the peace talks. They said basically that they are going to achieve the two main points, whereby the militia groups hand over their weapons to the state and whereby the militia groups will withdraw from the cities. The fact is, there is no state to speak of,
yes.
So the militia groups have no entity to put weapons to, and it is very unlikely for those militia groups to withdraw from the cities.
Yes, so that makes it far more complicated. We'd like to focus on the humanitarian situation. In terms of the humanitarian situation, is that the main issue at the moment?
It is. While the political jousting is going on with the UN, with the different various parties, the sad fact is that the Yemeni people are suffering. 82% of the population now needs aid. And with the UN trying to fund that aid, not succeeding so far. They only funded, I think it was 13% of their plan for aid in Yemen, which means that aid is not forthcoming anytime soon for that 82% of the population. You're talking about 22 million people who are in need of that aid. So the situation on the ground continues to deteriorate humanitarian-wise. And with the Saudi-led coalition not pitching in a lot of money as much as they are for the military, the situation is not improving anytime soon.
Yeah, so there are various factors here now. You spoke about the Saudi role. Besides Saudi, which other nations have involved themselves in Yemen?
Well, you have the various levels of involvements. You have, of course, the military involvement, which is the Saudi-led coalition, basically the GCC countries, the Gulf Cooperation Council, Kuwait, Emirates, Bahrain, Qatar, and also Jordan, of course, and Morocco. That's basically the Saudi-led coalition's military involvement. And, of course, you have the political involvement, which is basically the United Nations Security Council and the international community. Then you have countries that are backing the Saudi-led coalition, like the UK, France, and the guys who are selling weapons to the Saudi-led coalition. And that's what makes it even more complicated. You have multiple layers of involvement.
Yes, undoubtedly, as you outlined, that it makes it more complicated. Now, one basic amenity that will be of concern is the electricity. How is the electricity situation currently?
For the past almost now 10 months, there's zero electricity in the capital of Sana'a, as the majority of governorates of Yemen, the provinces of Yemen. In Aden, it's a different scenario because the coalition has named it the temporary capital of Yemen, so they have generators, backup generators that installed it. I think it was the UAE that installed it. It's a better situation. They have 2 hours on, 2 hours off electricity, which is much better than the rest of the governments who have virtually had zero electricity for the past 10 months. But people have learned to cope. You have a lot of people who have installed solar panels. Unfortunately, because those are expensive, and almost 50% of the population is under the poverty line, not a lot of people can afford them.
Yes, so there is a problem with regards to electricity where people are unable to afford it. Is it true that all Yemenis are armed? Is this a custom or just for protection?
It is more of a custom. Yemen, I think it was the second worldwide in terms of guns per capita. It's a gun culture. When you're 8 years old or 10 years old, your father basically gives you a gun. When you're almost 14 or 16, he would give you an AK-47. But it's not as bad as it sounds, because you don't go and fight and shoot everyone with a gun. It's more of something as a rite of passage that is given to you to teach you some sort of a responsibility, and because it's a popular thing in Yemen for you to have a gun. A lot of people, of course, carry the jambiya. Jambiya is a form of dagger that the Yemenis traditionally wear for decades. Following on that tradition of always having a weapon on you, when guns used in Yemen, it was another additional accessory. It was just another weapon that you would carry around, you would rarely use, but it's always part of your identity.
Yes, so the jambiya, people are very, you know, what happens when they have problems fighting amongst themselves? Just a quarrel. Are they quick to draw the knife? I've noticed that amongst people who have been influenced by the Yemenis, like the Somalians who are in South Africa. You know, sometimes they have a quarrel amongst them and they're quick to draw the knife. So is that a similar culture amongst the Yemenis?
Unfortunately, no. And actually, fortunately, no. Because there are taboos. There are red lines. If you draw your knife, you pay a huge fine in a fight. If you even draw blood, it's almost 10 times the fine. Because it's seen as a very cultural taboo. If you draw your knife, it's snatched. Even if you're angry, you need to control it. You draw your knife, you pay a hefty fine of about $1,000. You draw blood with that knife, you pay a fine of about $10,000. Even if it was not your fault, the fight was not your fault, even if you were attacked, that is a very cultural taboo. That's one of the restrictions that has been placed for almost decades here in Yemen to sort of limit the number of accidents so that cooler heads would prevail, so that people would be less likely to quickly draw the knife and stab someone whenever you're angry.
But on the other hand, you know, we spoke about earlier about, you know, the government and statehood and all of that with almost a dysfunctional government. How will you impose fines like that?
Well, for instance, like the jambiya and the guns, it has been essentially rooted in us. It's one of the tribal values more than the state law. But the fine that I just talked about, it's enforced mostly by the tribal and common law more than the state law.
Ah.
So those kind of things are a tradition more than civil law. And if you draw jambiya and you draw blood, it's the family and the tribe that basically enforce that fine upon you. It's not the government or the police.
Yes.
And that is still around, even despite the fact that the government is not around anymore.
What is the message that you'd like to leave our listeners with, Hisham?
Well, the message is never, ever get into a civil war. The fact is, any civil war, people assume that it's going to be a conflict and it's not going to take long. It's 1 year, 2 years. But even if it does, the sad fact is that it rips the social fabric. Even if the war ends within a few months or a year, the effects, it's generations will pay for that effect, for that impact of the war. We've seen it in Yemen, we've seen it in Somalia, we've seen it across the world. It is not a simple matter. It is not what they see in Hollywood or the movies. where one party wins and it's over and it's happy times. No, generations will pay the price for that war.
Yes, I suppose it's not something that people would voluntarily enter into. It sort of comes upon you before you realize it, or it just comes about without having an option in the matter. A powerful message in that regard, and we appreciate your time. We'll continue praying for Yemen and highlighting the issue over the airwaves. Jazakumullah khair for your time on Radio Islam.
Barakallahu fiik.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. That was Hisham Umaisi speaking to us about Yemen. We heard the documentary, and now speaking to someone from Yemen, giving us the latest details of how things are at the moment. As he said, that there is a period of stability at the moment, that there's been a ceasefire, but how long will that last, and what is the actual impact of it remains to be seen, whether it will be durable as such.